So what do you think about this chapter you've been dedicated to the English, to the language? What do you think about that? Why? The race of English. What is, in your view, the conclusion of that chapter? What he's trying to... So he made a connection in two things. I mean, he started to discuss the notion of literature, okay? And secondly, he started to discuss the idea of English. Why do you think they are entangled? I mean, why they are going together? I mean, let's put it in this way. If English became a dominant language, I mean, it's a vehicular language, it's a language for work, it's a language for communicate almost everywhere in the world, people will tend to see that as an instrument, not necessarily as an aesthetical tool. So why you think Eagleton tried to make a point about something that normally people don't do? I mean, normally people do what they do. What they say is that the language of literature are what? Italian, if you want, French. Normally they associate English with work, with computers, languages, and so on. So what is the element here that you think Eagleton tried to discuss, and that is why the reason why he did that? His ideology. He tried to discuss the idea that every empire have a language, and he makes some kind of associations with Latin, how the Romans were in some ways or the other making a standard of empire, using the language not only in terms of bureaucracy and politics, but as well in terms of aesthetics. So what he will point out is that seems to be for him inevitable that when we discuss literature, we discuss English itself as a language which is dominant in one way or the other. Why? Well, basically because theories tend to be expressed more and more in English, because the language who is the common language to all the people, including people in academia, is English. So he makes a sort of prediction, basically, that literary theory is literary theory English, basically. He thinks that because this have an ideology, I mean, he thinks that there is an empire who imposes people, culturally speaking, this language, because that he thinks that this instrumental theory is going to affect the way in which we do literature. And that means that the parameters of the Anglo-Saxon literatures are going to be used in other languages. If you closely look what happened in France nowadays, you're going to see that. I mean, there are a lot of people in France who are writing in French, like Anglo-Saxon authors, in the way in which they present the books, in the way in which they conceive the plot, in the way in which they present the book, in the way in which they make the first reading of the book, making the interpretation. They write in French, but they behave as an Anglo-Saxon author. That was what Eagleton, in one way or the other, was predicting. It is interesting because it's difficult in another language, an example in Russian, or an example in Castilian, in South America, because the language are so self-referential that the influence of English is not that strong, not yet. Same count for Japanese, Chinese, even for Turkish, which is a very strange language. But what I'm saying to you is that, as he suggested, you have an empire which you have a core, and then you have the peripheria. And the peripheria, as in the medieval times, things are messed up, are not very clear. So, in the two ways, either because the dominant power is not very clear, or either because the victims are not necessarily victims. So it's a two-way out thing. And some people say that that is a more interesting part of analysis nowadays of the culture. That's why they invented these post-colonial studies, who object of a study is these gray areas of the periphery in which nothing is clear, everything is mixed. If you ask a Latin American specialist a definition of Latin American culture, what they say? Mix. No one, several of them, which is true in some way, so general, can mean everything, but it is true because there are these kind of different use of the languages. They, of course, English affect and they introduce English, but they don't introduce it in the sense in which it's an aesthetical parameter as a package agreed to a language and you use it. No, became mixed, integral, and then you have all these silly exchange. An example, in Castilian you can use only one adjective per sentence, alright? So, but in English you can use quite a lot. So there are people who try to introduce that different noun in only one sentence in Spanish, and sometimes works. I mean, and that has to do as well. Some people were doing that in the 17th century as well. So you see, this is the kind of thing that happened in the periphery. But the idea of this man is that there is a strong ideology, and behind this ideology there is no language, and behind this language there is an idea of literature. These things are going together. This is important because this is the root of Marxism that Eagleton had. And when we are going to see Marxism, we are going to understand why. I mean, so one thing being the other. Okay. So that's one point. Let's explore the second point now. One theory. As you know, a lot of people, well, a lot of my colleagues, still do not understand why we need theory. What is the meaning of theory? They see theory, or the world of theory, as a sort of monster. They see that the perception is there is something difficult, is something that is not very clear, what use we can do of that, is something that could be a jargon, or is something who have a sort of a special language but only for happy few and not only people understand that. Basically, which is self-referential. So this is the understanding, or the common understanding of theory. Well, let me put it in this way. The world is very complex. We cannot understand, as people used to believe in the 16th century, that you make a perception, sensible perception of the world, and say, that's a tree, and that we're going to be automatically knowledge of what is the meaning of tree. Things are not that simple anymore. So, the reality, let me put it in this way, the reality of our world is invisible. What we call reality is not stable. What we make reality is an atom, depression. That is a reality. But what it is? It's physical? No, it's invisible. So we more and more move to a culture in which what we understand as a reality is something that we cannot touch, we cannot see. So the question for you is this: how you can analyze a culture as such, in which the important things are not visible? So was easy for people in the 16th century, because the people in the 16th century, they were saying, this is the world, okay? They called it at that time nature. For them, this was self-contained. Nature was having different laws. Was having a particular logic, so it was self-contained. So the purpose of the philosopher, if you want, or for the critic, was to try to understand this law. As more you understand this law, better is going to be the understanding of yourself. Basically, as more you know about the law of nature, better representation you can make. And as better representation you have of nature, better painter you are, better writer you are. You see, this is a scheme that goes from, I don't know, 16th century, let's say, almost to the 19th century. I mean, think an example in all the English and French literature, Dickens. Example. Dickens was grounded in this. Dickens was writing for people who were seeing his book as a sort of representation of what was going on. You know, the child labor, or London, with all these foggy places and I mean, I remember, I think it's in Hard Times, there is this beautiful description of the Old Bailey, who, as you know, they used to cut heads there. Yeah. You know that? Where there is you see there is a statue in front of a, when you go to Fleet Street, there is a statue where that statue was not there. It was a sort of table in which people were putting the head and they were cutting the head. And the Deacon says that there were so many blows that the blow was going down, 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 and right to the river. Exaggeration. That's the 11th century. Or Minsola, men, another place, or what, in France, we have plenty of them. I mean, this idea that as more you get into the physical world, equal reality, better is going to be your knowledge. An example, Zola is famous. He went to do some works to feel how that was, and then write the book. You see, this naive approach is because these people were really believing that reality is equal to physical world. Well, let's say that what happened is that. Let me finish the name here. Okay. Well, let's say a woman better. Well. What happened is at the beginning of the 20th century, a lot of people say, well, this kind of separation between, let's say, the object, nature, and the subject who observe nature cannot make anymore. So what we have is that the man is inside the world. Who says so? Several people. You want the most notorious one? Heidegger. Heidegger created this term, Dasein. Be in the world. He says, this skill of the 19th century is not true. We never can walk away from our condition as a human being. We never can say, that is a world, I'm here. Never. Because we are there. Okay? That is the first thing who happened at the beginning of the 20th century. There is a second thing who happened at the beginning of the 20th century as a consequence of this. Some authors started to think that this idea of nature with capitals who have laws was not saying not true, was not possible to defend anymore as a theory. They say the world is too complex and never we are going to arrive to have the, let's say, 10 or 15 laws who can really tell us what is the world about. And also because the idea of reality starts to switch from this physical dimension into a less physical dimension. And there are several things who happen, historically speaking, who have influence on this. All the avant-garde movement from the aesthetical point of view, the two world wars, all the experience of the Nazism, all the experience of the post-colonial, if you won't call it in that way. I mean, all the countries in Europe were losing the colonies. I mean, all the things who happened, let's say, in 1450 years in Europe, in some ways push things in this direction, in the direction in which people start to think that reality is not grounded in nature anymore. So, what we know now, and it's another problem as well. So, problem number one, the man in the world. Problem number two, no more nature with capitals. And now, problem number three. So, let's imagine you have a table. Yes, okay? So, if we accept this, if we accept that there is no one table, I mean, like a someone can say, if we have nature with capital, what we need is a model, dead table, and then the other will be copying that. So that's not true anymore. We have many tables. Number one. Number two, we have a concept of a table, and we have the physical table. Okay? So two things completely different. So you have the concept, and you have a table as such, physically speaking. But then, you have someone who made interpretation of these two. Let's say, for example, for someone in Russia, this is not a table. Why? Because they think a table is something which is completely made of wood, an example. So, what is the problem here? Is that for this Russian lady, the concept of table is rather than wood. And she came across to a real table, let's call it that way, which is made in plastic. So there is a problem there. There is a conflict. Okay? So what I'm saying to you is that in our new world, we have this trilogy, which is called sign. And this is a problem for our culture, because we have signs. Our culture is populated by signs that inside everyone have this conflict. Sometimes a conflict, sometimes not. But you always need to take in consideration three things: the physical system, the concept you have about a particular aspect of the physical system, and the interpretation. Okay? So, I'm asking you again now, after this description, why we need theory? It's very simple. If we don't have theory, we never are going to understand this. Because we need to understand, maybe in some cases, who is making the interpretation, or in some cases, we need to understand the physical system. We cannot imagine, if I ask you, what is a sign? I'm sure you never came across to someone to a sign walking on campus. It's no material. You don't see it. You don't have perception of a sign. So that is why you need a theory to understand what you cannot see. You see, this is the problem of our culture. You have plenty of people who discuss it in a simple way, in a very sophisticated way. An example: someone who discusses these things in a very simple way is called Paul Virilio. Two books from him: War and Cinema, in which he discusses the relation between war and cinema, and why they are entangled and why they are developing together. Or, if you want, in a more difficult way, The Aesthetic of Disappearance. Both are in the library, so you can get it. Is that clear? Make any sense for you? Too complicated? Too simple? You never came across to this?
No, well, in philosophy, maybe.
Because it's
not really. Well, the thing is that we understand we have different theories, and no theory is actually true or wrong, but this is, there are different concepts in order to understand things.
Yes, okay. Exactly. That's what it is. And that is called constructivism.
And that's why I am supposed to read a lot of things and then agree on something.
Yes. Because our knowledge is instrumental. This is the big change who happened, let's say, starting in the 17th century. For a 17th century people, aesthetics was a way of life. I mean, writing, doing paintings, and philosophy was a way of life. For some people in the 19th century, even, was a sort of moral or ethics purpose. But what changed in the 20th century is that knowledge is instrumental. It's not moral anymore, it's not aesthetic anymore, it's instrumental. You use it. And that's what we call, or these people, this author, we call it consumism. Because culture became something that you can buy. You see? This is the big change. For our people in the 17th century, never will be accepting money in exchange of producing poetry, for example. Never will be accepting that you can buy a poem. That would be completely unacceptable. But that is a big change. Now, yes, you can do that. So, if is that the situation, well, then, of course, you need a theory. Because you have symbolical values. If you, I'll give you an example. You arrive one day in campus with a trabant. You know what is a trabant? This small car from the East Germany. And the next day, you arrive in a Mercedes. So what interpretation you do of this? Not you, but the people who see you. In the first one, you're a miserable, poor, bohemian lady. In the second one, you're a sort of Porsche lady, plenty of money. Why? They know your bank account. They don't have a clue. They are watching the car. Why? Because the car is a symbol of you. One represents poverty, and the other represents riches. You see? And this is the symbolic. This is the value, if you want, calling the word. If you an example, I don't know. Let me put an example in France. If you go to the École Normale Supérieure de Paris, it's one thing. If you go to a school college in Marseille, it's another thing different. Why? Because culture has value. And one thing is going to an Grand École in Paris, and another different is to go to Marseille. You see? So, it's not ethical, it's not moral, it's a value. So, to understand this value, we need a theory. And the people, well, the guy, the men who discuss this, is called Pierre Bourdieu. The translation, I think, is the roots of art. Literally from French, les règles de l'art. He is the person who developed this theory that our culture basically is a sort of market who have values, like a, I don't know, a football player, for example. So let's think in a football player. You think I don't know, Beckham, for example. Okay, you think how worthy is the guy? I don't know, millions. Okay, so you see the literary market. Salman Rushdie, he have a value as well. What is the value? How much money they pay for the next book, for example. You see? And you can go on and on and on and on and on. Not to talk about paintings or cinema, in which, well, that is more commercial than literature, even. Do you follow me? So what I'm trying to explain to you very, very quickly is this sort of change in the last 200, 250 years. So what I'm saying to you is, for someone who was living in the 16th century, the idea to have an abstract apparatus to understand what is going on outside that window was completely mad, crazy, because the only abstract system was the one in place to understand God. Okay? But when God is there, as Nietzsche states in the 19th century, and when we don't have any more this idea of simplicity, thinking that everything we perceive by the sense is going to be transforming knowledge, when that system is not working anymore, we are blind in one way or the other. Why? Because we are shooting in the dark, like at the sound, in the sense in which we need to construct something abstract to understand this darkness, if you want, in one way or the other. Some people who is pessimist, probably like Nietzsche, says that the culture is a sort of necessary illusion. So we construct this theory to feel a little bit better. But at the end of the day, we are not going to understand nothing. That's a pessimist approach, if you want. Eagleton, if you want, is a more optimist, because he has this idea or notion of ideology connected with knowledge. Okay? So, this is an idea of culture. From the visibility of the culture to invisibility of the culture. From the idea of reality in naturalist sense to the idea of reality, let's say, in the postmodern time. Okay? So, you don't need to get complicated with it. Just to give you now a panorama, in the sense in which, if you have these things in mind, when you approach a book, you are going to understand the context. Then you need to understand specifically the argument that Deleuze, for example, discussed. But you know there has been a switch in the last 200 years. Probably the best description of this evolution, the most sophisticated, and it's very, very tough to read, is Michel Foucault, Le Mort et les Choses. Foucault in English is The Things and the World. The Things and the World, I think. The Things and the World. He had a theory. He talked about something called episteme. And he started analyzing 16th century, go towards to our time, and he discussed how there is an episteme, who is a sort of image who dominate a particular period, and he tried to characterize this episteme. So he analyzed anthropology, he analyzed natural science, he analyzed philosophy, the main concept, and constructed an evolution. So he made an analysis of culture evolution. Of course, I mention this to you so you have an idea, because maybe you came across to this author. I'm not suggesting to you to go to read Foucault, because probably that will be, well, you can go and check and have a look and read the introduction, which is very funny. But that will drive you maybe far away. But this is the surrounding of our argument, so it's better you to know. So if we construct a theory if we accept, let's say that with all this discussion you are convinced, you want to be nice with me and you says, yes Claudio, we need theory, alright? So let's assume for a moment, so that means that we need two things. First, we need a plan, and second, we need concepts, alright? So this, if you want, in one way or the other, give us the space, the plan give us the space, the territory, and the direction, and the concept give us, if you want, the understanding, the nomination in the sense in which attribute name to a particular thing who didn't have it before. We have the idea of becoming, and we have the idea of knowledge. Right. So, if someone asks you, number one, why we should use theory, you have the answer already. If on top of that, someone could be more nasty and ask you, well, what is the meaning of theory? You say, well, it's very simple. We need a plan and we need concepts. And both need to work together. One, construct the territory, and the other, put the, if you want, the furniture to the territory. Okay? It's very simple like that. All the theory work in the same way. There are ones who are more complex and the others who are more simple. An example. Let's look one who is going to be almost forever. So imagine for a moment we have a house. So we are going to call this structure, and we are going to call this superstructure. So, one of the first person who start to discuss this idea that what we see is not what really is was this man called Karl Marx. There is one commentator of Marx, which is the one I'm going to use to simplify things. He's a French guy, a little bit crazy, Althusser, who have this small book, which is called Les Appareils Idéologiques de l'État, in English, The Ideology Apparatus of the State. And he said, according to Marx, our society is a building. So, and the behavior has a building, in the sense in which the more important thing is not what we see, but is what is underneath, is infrastructure. And according to Marx, that was a pure economical element. So we walk in the street, we don't see what is underneath of the house, but that is what really counts. And then we have something which is called, we can call it structure, which is visible, but is less important. But we have something more visible, which is the first stage. I don't know if you notice, but when you are walking in a city, you walk in a route, in a street, and what you see normally are the first part, I mean the first stages, because you're walking like that. You didn't pay attention to that. You tend to see what is the first stage more than what you see what is the ground, excluding if you look in the window. You see? Look at the people. Don't think in what you do. Look at the people in a narrow street, and you are going to see that the people is looking there. So, let's say this is the more visible part of the house, okay? But according to Marx, is the less important. It's a separate structure. And according to Marx, that was the culture. Because the culture, according to Marx, is something who uses to fake what is really important, and is this. And Marx called to that action of faking the real thing ideology. Of course, if we go to the German text of Marx, Marx is not necessarily saying that, but the interpretation of the people who follow Marx and the interpretation of Althusser go in that direction. It's a sort of simplification, but it's how historiography, if you want, in one way or the other, goes. So ideology equals mask something. Sorry, I start to talk on what time is now? You normally we can, well, I suggest to make a 10-minute break. What time is now?
10?
10 past 5. Okay. We do 5, 10 minutes? Okay? Or you prefer to, up to you. I'm okay. Yeah? We can stay. Okay, fine. Now, So for Marx, the idea is we follow ideology and we are going to understand what is behind. And Marx suggests that our understanding of history need to be grounded on that part that we don't see. And according to him, that ideology bring us to a sort of idea of production. So what are the instruments of production? Production in economical sense. How many ways or in how many systems of production we can identify in history? If we are able to identify these many ways to produce things within history, we are going to identify how many ideologies are. Marx was indicated 4 or 5, and I'll just explain to you very quickly. One was capitalism. And why Marx paid attention to capitalism? Well, for two reasons. Number one, because according to him, was present. Capitalism was the reality of the 19th century. But number two, because it is grounded in two things, who are very, very important. Plusvalía. This is very simple. And it's invisible as well. You are then. Okay, let's assume. This guy is 19. Alright? He is going to have a wife and he is going to die when he's 70. He is going to work up to 50. Alright? So, he starts to work at 19. He is a sort of, I don't know, a baker. Alright? So, he gets a salary. 10. And he worked 8 hours. And he carried on for, what, 30 years. To do the same job. Same salary, same amount of time of work. That's fine. But there is one thing which is missing there. When he has 19, physically speaking, he is powerful. So work 8 hours is nothing. 48 after 30 years work is not the same. So that, let's say, lose of power, biologically speaking, no one pay for it. Because it's not the same to pay to someone 1 hour if it's that someone is a well looking man, 19 years old, because he have a lot of force, let's say. If you hire someone who is 60 and you try to make with that 60 years old person the same work that with a 19, is not going to work. When you say, Claudio, that's obvious. Yeah, it's obvious, but no one pay you for that. And that invisible consume of yourself who is not recognized by the capitalist system is called in economy plusvalía. So you only have money according to a sort of a standard established by the society, saying 1 hour in work, physical work, represent £20, and that's it. No one has consideration who you are, if you are sick, if you are not sick, if you are 20 or if you are 50. This ignorance, this put aside of all these considerations, is what is called plusvalía. Because the right thing should be, according to Marx, to pay to you as well for this. Meaning, when you are 19, you get the double pay. Why? Because you are powerful and you produce a double. And when you are 40, you get less. You see, it's a sort of compensation. So, that was point number one. Point number two, another invisible element, characteristic from capitalism.